Hi, and welcome back to the Global Health Collective podcast, a student podcast led by the Global Health Department here at McMaster University. My name is Shania Bopa, and we started the podcast back in 2020 with the goal of making research more accessible. We hope you enjoy this episode. Thanks for tuning in.
We have with us today Dr. Bauman, the former Associate Vice President, Professor, and Director of the WHO Collaborating Center in Primary Care, Nursing, and Health, Human Health Resources. And we have Dr. Anand, the Associate Vice President of Global Health, Professor of Medicine, and Director of the Chan Chuan Research Center. The session today will be moderated by Dr. Gilberto and our Assistant Professor in the Global Health Department. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you, everyone, for coming and welcome. I'm really excited to be with you today and with our two speakers. I think this is a really fantastic opportunity for us to learn from their experience and also have some really interesting conversations about global health and where it might be going. So we're going to just put up one slide. I don't know how many of you are familiar with this little diagram. It's from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research Framework for Action on Global Health Research. And it's a nice slide because it gives us a little bit of a snapshot of how global health has been changing and evolving. So we see here that it started in this protection of colonial representatives from tropical diseases. So it was very much a one-way flow of resources with an attempt to try and keep people who were visiting other countries for various reasons to keep them safe and healthy. And it evolved into Global Health 2.0, where wealthier countries such as Canada were helping other countries that had less resources or less access to resources. And now we're trying to move into a new version of Global Health 3.0 that emphasizes collective action to address shared risks and responsibilities. So this conceptualization of Global Health 3.0 has a multi-directional movement that's within and between local and global spaces in an attempt to demonstrate the collaboration that's required for making progress on health and well-being. So this is a conversation that we're going to explore today, this intersection of local and global, and what this might mean for students and educators. And I'm going to challenge our sessions today to not think necessarily of global, because this is another term that comes up in global health that we might not really even know what it means. It is equally as contested as global health itself. But instead, I want us to focus on how local and global considerations can be brought into conversation with each other and what might be achieved as a result. So this might be thinking about how we can do research and education across different local places in ways that value local perspectives, but also transcend national boundaries. So we're going to start off with a question to both of our discussants. And they may have something to add before they even answer the question, which is also great. But our first question is, if you can describe how you have brought together local and global considerations for health access and equity in your work as researchers and educators. Dr. Bowman?
Well, we already decided we were going to answer that question. So No, I'm just kidding. But what we were just talking, Sonia, Deborah, and I before, saying what's the best way to answer the questions. And I think we thought we'd set the stage with just talking about, first of all, the issue of the definition of global health and how global health started. It's a term probably been around a long time. I've never done research to find the original naming. But it really started with a vengeance, I would say, 12 to 15 years ago. And it replaced the term international health, because there was, I think, this sort of epiphany that international health is not something that's international. National health is something that goes through all populations. It's usually in many countries the largest sector, health and education. So, and international health had all those other baggage issues, which we read about, which many authors have spent a lot of time, especially in the past decade, talking about colonialization and all that kind of thing that happened in the past. So for all these reasons, international health, which had meaning to many of us in the old days, global health began to replace it. And it was seen as a much broader term, a much deeper term, a term that allowed the examination of health within the context of something called global health. At the same time, we had very traditional sciences all around the world. Public health is a very traditional science. It's a well-established field. It's got all the research, epidemiology behind it, very established. And there was confusion, a lot of confusion, international health, public health, global health. For the students who were first in the class, because global health here at McMaster was one of the first, that was a point of great confusion for them. And in fact, it was a point of great confusion for public health, who said, well, we got public health, we don't need global health. But what you see in the last 12 years is a lot of writing to try to further understand the term, the meaning of the term. The term is very broad. It's very multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary. People often say, well, so is economics. But yes and no. But global health allows the entry point in for other disciplinary perspectives. And so does public health. But, you know, these older fields, it doesn't mean that it replaces. It's a partner. So public health will often say, well, we're international too, and they are. So you'll have global health practitioners now in the field, and you have public health practitioners. And they're often doing different things. And that's probably a subject for another day. What do global health practitioners really do? What are our alumni doing? And maybe perhaps that could be a point of another discussion that some students might be interested in, because they are doing very different things. And the writings in global health are really getting closer and closer to giving what I get a more deeper understanding of what this field of global health is. So when Sonia and I were talking and Deborah were talking, the first question, local and global considerations, the fundamental principle is that health goes across all populations. And, you know, again, with mobility and migration, you know, in your own community, everybody, a lot of people have to move, and we don't want to talk about the recent crises, but people are, another million or 2 million people are on the move again. So this local global is really important, because you are living somewhere local, and you may want to make your major contribution in your local area, but you're a graduate of global health. But what we thought we'd do today, the first thing today, is to talk about the local global, local and global. Because many of you will stay, some of you will travel, some of you will maybe, you don't know where you're going to find yourself. None of us can say for sure. So we thought, first of all, the local global is a way to talk about it, but it's a way to try to understand this broad feeling, broad definition of global health. And what is global health? Because you are, all of you, global health practitioners of some type. You all have different backgrounds, which is really exciting. Usually struggling with similar problems from different perspectives, though. So I'm going to pass it over to Sonia for the next comment about local global.
Yeah, thank you very much, Andrea. And I mean, I think it first came to my mind when I was a medical student trainee, and when we would see patients in the hospital, some of our patients came from other countries, and we had to have a kind of a broader view of what could be the cause of a fever than just our local infectious diseases. Yeah. So if you came from India or Africa and you had a fever without an explanation, we had to start thinking of some tropical diseases, and maybe that's, you know, 1.0 global health writ large. But that was my individual experience, that I, as a citizen of Canada, should be aware of what's going on in the world. And that translates into also understanding the geopolitical environment, who's coming to Canada, why they're coming, are they coming for economic reasons or are they refugees? All of the understanding of the world is important at home, because in our local environment, we have a very diverse society now. And so that struck me. On the other hand, when people come to Canada with certain experiences, we can learn from them. We can learn from how they overcame some of the challenges that perhaps we're just facing. So the idea of the global, I think, is it's an interesting one. And for students in global health, you're learning principles and concepts that don't only apply to, you know, low middle income countries. Many mm-hmm. of the principles, concepts, and the way to solve those problems can be applied here. And maybe the resistance here was back in the global health 2.0, where high income countries, typically we thought we have the answers for the world's problems and didn't have that openness to hear maybe solutions from people who've come from outside to help us solve our own problems. And this, I would say, really came to my mind around some of our indigenous relationships. And I remember bringing some outside visitors to Canada and, you know, talking about how great our healthcare system was, universal healthcare access. And my outside partners said, well, can you tell me more about Indigenous peoples of Canada? And when we started that conversation, you know, we realized how disadvantaged Indigenous peoples in Canada are. Learning the history is crucial. And then we could learn from outside groups about how to do better in our own country. So those are a few opening comments.
Thanks so much. And it's really interesting to me because what I'm learning and hearing from the two of you is really about this bi-directional, multi-directional flow of information and learning and resources. And I think that this comment you made, Dr. Anand, about, you know, understanding that we being sort of North American or Western European institutions, we don't have the answers, that it's about working in collaboration with people. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more, both of you, about how you've made that a reality. So what does that look like when we start to acknowledge and have humility to say, oh, we don't have the answers, but we are looking to work together to find a solution that works? What does that mean, or what might that look like, acknowledging this global and local collaborations?
I think one of the words I had written down actually was humility. And I think, again, it's something everyone has to work at, the concept of humility, but recognizing, as Sonia said, there are many answers to complicated health problems. You know, we'll have the medical answer, we'll have the nursing answer, we'll have the social work answer. You know, all the health professionals have been taught a lot of answers to questions. And they often, we have intractable issues in health that often we cannot sometimes overcome. And partly the answer comes from the people who are either undergoing it or listening to people. I am originally a health professional, a nurse. Once you're a nurse, you're always a nurse. Once you're a midwife, you're always a midwife. I guess once you're a doctor, you're always a doctor. But the thing is that, you know, we were taught to listen. I don't think we listen that well as a profession. We do sort of listen, but we are also taught the answers, right? So you have big fat books of answers, evidence-based practice, and you get all this in your head, and then to try to listen to someone, truly listen, deep listening is very hard. And that's this, again, issue of health. And no matter where you are, who you're talking to, is to try to really listen to their background. Because if you look at our class alone, we have wonderfully classes from all over with rich experiences, sometimes experiences that are not so rich, sometimes tragic experience, but to listen to each other, to solve some of these global health issues. There are projects. Canada does go abroad a lot. Canada is known to be relatively generous with their aid. But even the word aid is probably a misnomer. Mm-hmm. But I will say something in favor of Canada, that when they do large international projects, the funding goes largely to the site. And Canadians are usually running it. That's usually in accounting. But it's definitely local, although hiring is local. So Canada has tried, you know, with overseas projects, not to be too top down, but to really engage local communities. And that is not new. That's been an old philosophy of the Canadian government. Does even that really work? Well, it works somewhat, but not, I guess that's another topic for another day. But again, it's listening to the local communities, listening to the people who have the issues. And we know even in downtown Hamilton, we have very problematic issues of that population. Some of them don't see it as a problem, though, and some of them do need or would like some assistance. Not unusual if they're very poor, have issues of unemployment, issues of health, they're struggling with lots of things. Again, you can see that in another local community in another country. It has different ways of expressing itself, but some of the, I think, interventions that you would take as a global health practitioner, what you do as a global health practitioner, would be similar. It wouldn't be that different because you're really there to help people, right? This is a helping field. It's a very theoretical field too, very theoretical, but it's also a field that was designed to assist populations that are in dire distress often. So that's what I would say. I'll pass it over to Sonia.
Yeah, thanks. And I would I'd pick up on the first term you used, Andrea, humility being crucial. And I can think through the course of my career where I needed a reminder about humility. So the first research project I did as a resident I wanted to do international health, and it was called that 25 years ago here at McMaster. It was the International Health Office with Vic Neufeld and others. Right. And I was interested in the care of patients who suffered a heart attack. And so I did a comparative study between Hamilton General Hospital and a hospital in India. And a lot of people say, well, for sure, we're going to be better here. You know, we're evidence-based mm-hmm. and we have universal healthcare access, et cetera. So I did it. And Canada was better in getting patients with symptoms of heart attack to hospital faster because we have an ambulance system. But in the hospital in India, once the patient got through the door with the heart attack, they got their thrombolytic therapy and aspirin faster than they did here in Hamilton. So that was, you know, I could have gone in saying, of course we're better, but actually the results show, you know, this hospital did better in one aspect. So humility lesson. And then, you know, in some of our work here, and members of my research team will often have to remind me, as academics, we can say, well, the evidence would suggest this is the solution. So let's apply that to the community, mm-hmm. be it local or outside of Canada, without taking into account the people with lived experience, be they people in a community mm-hmm. or patients with a disease. And that's so crucial to do. And it takes longer, sometimes harder. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you already have a design in your mind and you have to change it based on their input. So I would, again, that's a lesson in humility that people who are affected by the disease, health condition, whatnot, have a lot to say and should have a lot of input. And my final point would be that the structure, although we're trying to move away from Global Health 2.0, mm-hmm. is it was structured in a way to really be high-income country dominated because high-income countries hold the resources. So then if you're sending resources or grant mm-hmm. funding, you kind of instruct how it should be run and how, you know, who should spend the money and who decides and who does the accounting. So it's already set up that wealthy countries are dictating what lower middle income countries do. And also the journals, the committees, et cetera, are all structured like that. So that who are the editors of the highest impact journal are relatively non-diverse, high income country, old school academics. So along comes a paper that they haven't been involved in or research project. They may not agree on a co-design model. So it's not published in a high impact journal. So you can see there's inequity there. So there are kind of layers upon layers of things that have been established in Global Health 2.0 that will take time to undo. So just having an awareness of that, and then as you embark on your career in global health, will be where do you fit in that current structure and how might you go about changing it?
And I think the idea, this idea of humility and taking a broad look, a broad perspective at what is happening, is really important for not only us as students and as educators, but also as citizens. And this idea that the work that we're ultimately doing in global health is for people so that our planetary health, our whole health of the planet and populations together can rise. Mm-hmm. And I think what's and we are learning more and more about is the need to have a wide perspective that isn't dominated by any one way of thinking or any one disciplinary approach or any one country or any one funding mechanism. And I think this is really exciting because global health in a way is starting for us to realize how we can start to have a wider perspective, not only in topics, but in the methods that we choose and how we approach things, people we work with, countries we work with. So I'm wondering from the both of you, what you see as really exciting opportunities for this idea of connecting local learning. So we acknowledge that our North American or our high income perspectives are not necessarily where we have all the answers, and that certain disciplines aren't always where we have all the answers, and that we're listening to people on the ground in the communities for whom we work and with whom we work. How can we start to connect their local perspectives in this idea of acknowledging that local feeds into the global? So we change this direction. Are there opportunities from your work that you've heard about of how local knowledges are being connected and are being amplified to have an influence globally?
Good question. It's a hard one.
I think it answers with the audience.
Okay.
Actually, because in graduate school, it's reading, 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 whether it's the PhD or the master's, you're reading, reading, reading so many articles, so many things. It's just your head, by the time your first year or a year's over, your head exploding with all this information. And you're reading many, many different perspectives. And it sometimes causes confusion because you're actually looking for answers, right? I always like answers. Give me the answers, but the answers are sort of there, but they're sort of not. You're highly foundation one or perhaps foundation two in the master's program, again, will emphasize that what is the reality behind the written word? And that's often our first experience about the reality behind the written word. The written word is very fascinating and amazing, and you read a book, but always think about what's behind the book, who's writing the book. A lot of the publications are in English. It's a huge domination. I was reviewing an article yesterday. It was from China, written in English, and all you could say is there has to be some Chinese writers writing about this. There's got to be. There's a billion people. There's some very good academic institutions in China. There's academic institutions all around the world. Some of them struggling, mind you, but they're still. And many of the academics in those institutions are sometimes writing in English, but they're also probably writing in their own language or at least thinking in their own language. That is a huge loss. Is to lose that bridge between the original thinking in your own language and your thinking in English. And I do feel I think that'll be our next, I know that's not answering the question, but our next, we do think our next area will be translation. And I hope I'm going to struggle to stay alive for that day. My days probably numbered now. But the thing is that when we can talk together with whatever a person's original language was, and we can really, I do think there'll be even more learnings and more understanding, because we're actually missing probably half the world's insights, really, in some of these complicated problems. And even when teams go out to another country where, for example, English isn't spoken and translators are used, a lot is lost, right? It's, you know, you're the foreigner, they're the local person, they're struggling to help you come to some sort of common meeting. So I think that issue of the local, what's happening in local communities, there'll be more of a sharing as we break down some of the language barriers. Culture will always be there, and thank God, because it would be a pretty boring place if we didn't have so much diversity. It makes it interesting and exciting. But language is another issue, and language has lots of innuendo. So I think that that's one area where you'll start to see social media has made a big difference. You know, your ability to talk to your friends at home. You can talk usually, you know, using a different keyboard if you need to. So that's really helped the exchange of knowledge. But the formal exchange of knowledge is pretty dominant these days, I think, in English. We can maybe have another debate about that. Students should have a debate about that. That'd be another point for a podcast. That will help bring that local further understanding of complicated problems.
Yeah, thanks. And just two comments. One would be Indigenous ways of knowing. I've learned a lot over the years, again, from our Indigenous partners. And, you know, we've often hear them say, and I now repeat, it's nothing about us without us, to start with. And so we could apply that to any population group, community group, but also like their ways of knowing, just like you said, have either not been translated. It's an oral culture for many Indigenous communities. And that lesson came to me again during the wildfire challenges this summer in California and BC. And I heard a number of Indigenous scholars speak about controlled burns as something that Indigenous communities do to prevent the big burn. Unexpected big burn, and that had been outlawed and banned in the state of California. So you couldn't do the controlled burns, and then wildfires hit, and same with Indigenous peoples of Hawaii. So there is a lot we can learn. And the other lesson that came to me is in my research area of why people who originate from India have, you know, high rates of cardiovascular disease and diabetes. When I look back at the Ayurvedic texts of 3,000 to 5,000 years ago and the advice written in Sanskrit, it's very similar to what we say today in terms of, you know, what one should consume for a healthy diet, how one should manage stress and exercise, etc. So here we are after all our randomized trials and observational studies coming up with the same recommendations that may have been written 3,000 to 5,000 years ago. Shows to me that there is a lot lost in translation. There are a lot of texts ignored by, you know, conventional researchers, and we're reinventing a wheel that was already described many thousands of years ago.
And I think that's what global health does. In some ways, constantly trying to think of the difference of what the field of global health is versus these very traditional fields. They're old. They've been through the ages. To be called a field is a big thing in academia, because it means you have to have substantive knowledge within it. But I think this is, if you watch the global health writings, other fields don't necessarily tackle those kind of issues. Global health practitioners are tackling them. So again, it shows the evolution of the meaning of being a global health practitioner.
Yeah. And I'd add on that multidisciplinary creative components of global health. One of the Nobel Prize winners in economics, probably 4 years, Abhijit Banerjee and his partner Esther Duflo, they won the Nobel Prize in economics, and they used randomized trials in economics in low middle income countries. And so, first of all, we can learn a lot from the field of economics and what has worked there. And, you know, their creativity was still using the randomized trial, but, you know, if they're looking at malnutrition, they would pair, you know, collecting a bag of lentils and getting your vaccinations for various diseases to no bag of lentils. So the incentive is meeting both the nutritional demands and also enabling administration of a vaccination and then measuring multiple health outcomes. So, you know, the economic nudges and incentives benefit nutrition, economics, and health writ large. And so if we were really narrow in our health focus, not taking in from other disciplines, we won't be as creative and we won't up with solutions as quickly.
And I feel that's the really important and exciting part about global health is that this, you know, diagram we have here about global health 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0 is really talking about geography. So it's talking about high-income countries and low-income countries. But what we're talking about today is actually crossing so many different boundaries. So it's about crossing not only geographical boundaries, but disciplinary boundaries and cultural boundaries and language boundaries and how we can use global health as a means and a vehicle for bringing together this collaboration and this collective work that isn't just about, oh, we're trying to, you know, increase flow between two countries, but actually we're trying to increase flow between a whole different way of thinking. So we're trying to incorporate more understanding about the world that comes from medicine or comes from Ayurveda, that comes from different ways of thinking and knowing and being. And this idea of trying to, if we start to dispel this idea of, you know, these boundaries that are holding us in place, either physically in a physical place or in an intellectual space that's holding us into one way of thinking, and we start to remove those boundaries, what can we actually achieve? There seems to be that there's a lot of excitement and a lot of opportunities. And the caution I have in that is I'm an eternally optimistic person about what we can achieve collectively, you know, as people and as humanity, but also being really aware of the sensitivities of being local. So understanding that we don't want to have this sort of seductive reduction of someone else's problems. And just because it's beside me on the street or down my street, I can do something about it. And if it's too far away from me physically, geographically, I can't do something about it, or vice versa. And so I was curious about both of your thoughts on how our, as global health practitioners, we can adopt a mindset that allows us to think in this way where we are taking each problem seriously that we encounter, whether it's local physically or, you know, farther away physically, or a disciplinary boundary or a language boundary. How can we start to address some of the challenges, and what are some of the mindsets we need to have as educators and students and researchers?
I think it's personal responsibility. And I think that when you're in graduate school, you're getting powerful tools of knowledge and logic and information to put forth different arguments. And if you accept the premise that we're all here to help others, that's really the fundamental issue. You don't have to go far to go downtown Hamilton to see suffering. You can go to Jackson Square and stand there, and it's not an experiment. You'll see suffering. These are people who are suffering, and it's a problem. We've had issues to try to help people. Again, when you're in graduate school, you have the opportunity to really immerse yourself thinking about it and reading about it and questioning, and become a powerful influence for change when you see things in your local community. Working abroad is also, you know, something, or many aspire to, but it'll be the same issue where you'll be advocating and trying to help people to the best of your ability. And you have, as a graduate student, as a graduate, or as a researcher, powerful tools. You have the tool of knowledge, which a lot of people, they know they have an issue, but they may not know all the complexities behind it. And so, you know, working within global health, you also will learn and have learned that not everything is as it appears. And so you have to also help people navigate systems, because sometimes they're trying to navigate something that they can't understand why it's not working. And so that is the one thing I call the powerful tool of knowledge, and how you're going to use that knowledge. You could say, how's that different than social advocacy? Well, that's, I guess, another debate, but it's a type of advocacy using your knowledge. So I don't know what you would
think. Yeah, I think I'll add, maybe we'll come up with the four H's, but we talked of humility. I'd mm-hmm. also add the humanity, which mm-hmm. is, you know, very apparent in our own local environments, but also would be apparent if you go to a low middle income country. I know that I was first struck by that inequity when I traveled to India as a child, for example. Mm-hmm. So it really kind of sticks with you. And then the other is around health equity, because, you know, we have systems and structures in place in our own country, and other countries have their systems and structures that will lead to inequity. Mm-hmm. And so those systems benefit some and, you know, lead to marginalization for others. Mm-hmm. And trying to kind of change systems and structures to kind of help those populations and individuals in need is something that I think many global health practitioners will take with them. And it sometimes feels like you're beating against a brick wall to change those systems and structures. But when you see the health need apparent, yeah, that's a strong motivator. And we learned a lot of those lessons and experienced that in the COVID-19 pandemic. Mm-hmm. And we'll learn more about that on October 30th. So I invite you all to come here, the Andrea Bellman Health Equity Symposium. But just how, you know, we're all going along thinking, you know, we'll leave the infectious disease administration to someone else. But then you hear of people or communities who don't have access to testing or don't have access to vaccination, many of us felt like we just can't sit around. We have to do something to try and change the system in which we live and work. So I think always being aware that systems are created often by individuals who will benefit. There will be people who are suffering, and that comes back to our humanity and humility to try and get in there and change things.
And I like those two words, humanity and humility. So I was asking you this question about mindset. And I think what we learn as students and we try to teach as educators and do as research is always about the things we can do, the methods we can employ, or the things we can read, or the answers we can come up with, whether they're answers we define individually or work through with communities. But this mindset, this idea that actually at the bottom of all that, at the heart, at the root, before we start to layer on all of our technical expertise and all of the disciplinary expertise, is really this idea of humility and humanity and approaching challenges with curiosity and understanding complexity, and that things are very complex and systems are exceptionally complex, but not to let that overwhelm us, and to understand that when we approach things with the understanding that we can work together in collaboration, we might actually be able to, you know, change a system. And there's the quote, and I believe it's by Margaret Mead, that, you know, never doubt that a small group of people can achieve change, mm-hmm. because that's in fact the only thing that can, is collective action. I think that's a really exciting way of thinking about local global health, is that we are working in these collective small groups of people, and they might be small groups because you're physically located, but they could also be small groups or networks of people around the world, mm-hmm. that are working towards a shared understanding of a problem or a challenge. And that might be a really great opportunity for us to be thinking about global and local health intersections. It's how we can work locally, but not physically or geographically locally, but locally in terms of understanding that we are a group of people trying to come to a connected understanding that will then ideally influence a larger challenge, a systemic challenge or a global challenge.